Okay, so what I will do in the remainder of the talk is I will give you some insight into the computation of delta rho of rho, in particular quantum or high energy corrections to the standard computation. So remember, delta rho of rho is just related to the spontaneous pair creation from the vacuum, which is just the... And it's up to some normalization, which the cosmologists usually use. There's an extra factor of k to the 3. And this is the of the scalar field phi. And this is the strictly speaking, this is the Weidman function. Or you can relate it to the imaginary part of the standard Feynman-Greene's function, where you take t goes to infinity, and then there's this extra factor of k cubed, and if you're really precise, there's some 2s and pi's as well. But you simply have to therefore compute the two-point correlation function in a field theory. Well, that's not so hard. The way the cosmologists usually computed this, in cosmology, time evolution is very important. They usually used in the Hamiltonian point of view, or canonical quantization. And to do that, to compute this correlation function, then of course had to choose a vacuum. So the normal way is you choose, excuse me? Yeah, it's the equal time t goes to plus infinity. Why do you do that? So the normal way you do spontaneous pair creation from the vacuum in regular field theory is the simplest way to see it is you want to compute actual pairs that you physically see in your experiment. So it's some kind of S matrix element from no particles to two particles. The easiest way to compute that, as in my personal opinion, is you take the one loop vacuum amplitude from vacuum to vacuum, is simply the partition function at one loop. And if you take the imaginary part of this, the probability of creating a spontaneous pair is simply the imaginary part of the one loop vacuum amplitude, or therefore the imaginary part of the standard Feynman-Greene's function. And if you recall the optical theorem, that effectively always means that you compute asymptotic states, which means the asymptotic limit is the limit when t goes to infinity. These are on-shell states, so the way you pick out the on-shell part is taking the time where you measure them infinitely far away from where the collision, or in this case, the moment of creation happened. Does that answer your question? Okay. So, okay. I'm not going to spend too much detail on it. I don't have time, but I can explain to you in person, and it's also in our papers explained in quite some detail. Okay, so they use the Hamiltonian formulation and canonical quantization, so we all know how it goes. You take the field phi, you expand it in creation operators and annihilation and creation operators, where U is a solution to the homogeneous field equation. But and U star is the other linear combination, and then you have to choose a specific boundary condition, where you have to choose a set of modes A in the, for which you annihilate the vacuum. And then you can compute this Weidman function quite easily. And the point is that because this is a linear system, there are many different ways you can choose this. You can choose a Bogle-Yubov transformation, which rotates... Let me just write it correctly before I... mix everybody up. Where you can choose a different linear combination of the two independent solutions to the field equation. V is U well, let me extract out an overall normalization plus B U star. And this will have then phi, you can decompose in terms of an A tilde V plus A tilde V star. And you can choose a different vacuum.
A tilde dagger,
yes. Okay. Now this ambiguity between vacuum choices you can resolve in standard flat space field theory by picking the one that is Lorentz invariant. But in cosmology, you do not have that extra symmetry. You only have the spatial rotations as a symmetry. The theory. So this is the famous cosmological vacuum ambiguity. You don't know which one to choose. Now there is a prescription that has emerged over the years. Literally, years of study has gone into it. And the only reasonable solution came out is a prescription for a choice of vacuum, which was called the Bunch-Davies vacuum. Now, the reason why I emphasize the word prescription is because there's no proof that this is the correct vacuum state. At the same time, there are many, many different consistency checks why the Bunch-Davies is a certain nice state. So, Bunch-Davies. So what is the Bunch-Davies vacuum? It's very simple. You compare the Green's function in the curve background with that for very high k momenta with that of flat space, and then you insist that they are the same. So this is the intuitive part behind these this Bunch-Davies is simply that at very, very small scales, the curvature of space-time does not matter. So it's a very intuitive and reasonable choice to make. And then what one simply does is, this decomposition is, of course, in terms of the spatial momenta. So one simply applies that vacuum rule for every single spatial momenta, the Bunch-Davies one.
Sorry, what do you mean every spatial momenta?
Okay, let me be a little bit more precise. So these mode functions U obey our solutions to box U is zero. Now this box U is zero is some differential equation of the following type. For a massless field, and then there can be a k is the spatial momentum. There is SO3 symmetry and SO3 translation invariance in an FRW universe. So the spatial components you can Fourier transform, and then there's a differential equation in dt left. So all these phi functions k, there's an index k which goes along, which is just this spatial momentum. And this comparison that one does between the curved background and the flat space background is the limit where the spatial momenta are very, very high. Then you can make the exact comparison. But of course, the low spatial momenta are still in the game. And one simply applies the same rule that you find for the high momenta to correspond to to recover the flat space limit to the low momenta.
But
all these momenta are independent.
But your comparison is at short distances, so why do all the momenta get mixed up in that question, no? I mean, when you're asking it, you cannot do mode by mode. At least it doesn't sound clear to me what you mean by that statement, the line above it.
Um, But you simply look at the very high K modes here. For the very high K modes, this is certainly correct. But for the low K modes, you simply...
may not be correct.
So it may not be correct.
So when you say you apply that, what was I going to say? You can only apply the high modes.
Yeah, strictly speaking, but what you simply... I mean, this expression, as formally, just has an index K.
Right.
And you can simply take the rule that you find for the high K modes, where you know it has to be correct, to extend it to the low K modes. Yeah. Exactly. That's what I mean.
But it's not motivated for small
K. No, it's not motivated for small K.
All you want is the green function, right?
Yes.
If you solve the green function in curved space, you find the inhomogeneous solution. And the homogeneous solution that you add is just the one so that the green function short distances looks like the bottom bracket.
That's not uniquely determined, because the Green's function will still ask to obey certain boundary conditions, or in this case, the vacuum. And because the boundary conditions can differ mode by mode. Yeah. So the comparison to at short distances that you want to recover the flat space Green's function is a short distance question. The boundary conditions that determine the homogeneous part is a long distance question. So a priori, you can't determine the one from the other. Okay, well, let me go on and we can discuss it in detail. I don't think this works. The homogeneous part, let's discuss it later. Okay. So the point is that if you choose another vacuum, so this is a prescription, you could have chosen another vacuum, which meant you rotate by this Bogueuf transformation, but this rotation you can choose to be k-dependent. Why not? And let me state one thing. So the Bunch-Davies vacuum actually precisely gives you that delta rho over rho is h over 2 pi, or recovers the Harrison Seldovich scale invariant spectrum that is confirmed by experiment to high accuracy. But you could choose a small rotation, and what you then find is that this power spectrum changes with, I find this guy B here. You find that the power spectrum P, which is the square of this actually, so remember P is d rho over rho squared, is the Bunch-Davies power spectrum, which is just a constant, times 1 plus 2 bk cosine of alpha of k plus delta. So one of the main issues you see if you change the initial state is you get an oscillatory component to your power spectrum.
So I see what BK is, but what's alpha K?
So alpha K is... let me see. BK is the following combination. BK is the absolute value of BK, absolute value times the exponent of I alpha of K. It's the phase of B. Okay? B can be complex. And this actually should have an absolute value.
What symmetries are you imposing for BK? So K alone depends on the norm of K, the rotational symmetry in K?
Yeah, so the only symmetries I'm imposing is that indeed everything has only SO3 invariance, so K itself is the term. If you impose more symmetries, then this number B gets restricted. In particular, if you impose all the De Sitter symmetries, B has to be zero. Then the Bunch-Davies vacuum is the only one that respects all the De Sitter symmetries. Of course, we don't believe that the inflationary phase was exact De Sitter, and we know it wasn't. So there's no reason to impose that from a phenomenological point of view.
But at the rate you're saying for large k, it's zero.
For large k, it's zero. So what people did in a first attempt to address some of these problems that the inflationary scenario was is particularly people were worried about the redshift issue, the massive redshifts that you have. Yes, Nathan. In this case, I'm doing a single scalar field in a curved background, fixed curved background. The scalar field.
So this is like your dilaton field or
inflaton field, dilaton field, yeah. Just the one scalar field coupled to in a fixed gravitational background. Gravity is not dynamical in this scenario.
So it's not related.
So think of Schwinger pair production in a constant electric field with electrons. This is the gravitational analog with scalars. Okay. Okay, so what people did in the beginning was simply say, well, if in quantum gravity or string theory, there's some cutoff scale where I should stop leaving all this story. In particular, you realize that the Bunch-Davies vacuum, where you take some high k limit, that itself may have be some problematic limit to take, if indeed the scale h of inflation is already so close to the Planck scale. So what they said is, we should simply cut off all our theory with a brute force cutoff, where the physical momenta, which is this k, actually is the co-moving momenta over the expansion scale a, is some fixed number. And what you find then is, since this is now a time-dependent condition, what they simply did is, at that time, they tried to impose some initial conditions, or at that time, they wanted to determine the vacuum state. And I'm not going to go into the details. One of the issues you can think of is that you want a minimal uncertainty state, which was the viewpoint of Danielson. You find that there's a very specific V that rolls out of this computation. The V of K is H over 2 im e to the minus 2 im divided by h 1 minus epsilon. Epsilon is the slow roll parameter that I mentioned before. Okay, so
the deviation is part being is captured by this V of k. Is that
no, this is two. There's two ingredients. One is this is slow roll inflation, so we have a deviation from the De Sitter. But I could have set epsilon to zero as the formal De Sitter limit, and I'm restricting myself to only physical momenta below a scale m. That means I cannot follow the strict Bunch-Davies prescription to choose a vacuum. So I'm using a different type of prescription to choose a vacuum. And what I'm doing is I'm not taking the full Bunch-Davies limit where I want to recover the flat space propagator, but I'm only take the limit where my momenta become this value.
So
I'm
not the motivation for that.
Because I'm doing classical general relativity, so I know that if I take momenta larger than m, I don't know anyway what the propagator. Yeah, this is m Planck, or the scale of new physics. So it's a refinement of the Bunch-Davies prescription.
But when you say you don't know what you do for that part, in other words, the data about what is the mode that bigger than Planck is not needed to determine the vacuum. You're giving a B of K, which makes sense for any K now.
This B of K makes sense for any K, but implicitly I'm restricting myself to. Okay, how do I...
As if you don't have any lack of information from the PFK, right? You're giving me the full vacuum. Whereas your new physics should have given you some continuity.
Okay. I'm trying to save some time, but I obviously shouldn't. Okay, this is the full prescription. Okay, you can think of the Bunch-Davies vacuum not just as taking high momenta, but also as taking limit T minus infinity. Mm-hmm. This is a condition. You can translate this condition that the physical momenta should be equal to a fixed scale and to a condition on the time scale, A of T. A of T is e to the ht. Right? So you can find a T. So instead of imposing Bunch-Davies conditions at t is minus infinity, we impose sort of boundary conditions at t is 1 over h log m Planck over k. Okay? Now you still have to tell me what is the condition that you choose, and you choose the so-called minimum uncertainty state. So you can compute the delta x, delta p for a given state, and there's one state which has precisely delta x, delta p is h bar, and that's the state you choose, and then you find that this b rolls out. In fact, you can show that the Bunch-Davies state is the minimum uncertainty state at t is minus infinity. That's why. So this is the precise prescription. Yeah. Okay. So this is one scenario. You can compute precisely with this B what the corrections to the power spectrum are. And there are some oscillatory behavior. And one of the... So in pure de Sitter, H is scale independent, but in slow roll inflation, H is not. So in slow roll inflation, H itself goes as K to the minus epsilon over H. So I'm going to try to leave this board, and I'm going to try to describe a different approach here, and then I'm going to compare the two approaches. So this is a very ad hoc, but it's and somewhat phenomenologically inspired approach, but it certainly gives you a handle on what possible corrections are. Most notably, actually, what we should note is that the correction here is linear in H over M. So if indeed the H is relatively high, as we expect from the Planck scale contributions, and M is the scale of new physics, or M Planck, if this number is relatively close, the corrections can be of order 1% to 2%, and already be visible in the CMB. If this is a smaller number, they can still be visible in large-scale structure. Although, I should qualify that statement later. One of the it's a very fruitful first approach, but what is clearly missing is some motivation behind these boundary conditions. In particular, we know that gravity or general relativity is a low energy effective action, low to scale and Planck. And what we really would like is that this some way or another, these high energy corrections follow from an action principle. If we have an action principle, then we can in principle make direct contact with string theory, if we would know how to compute the low energy effective action for a certain string compactification. So, yes.
Is this really a quantum gravity effect? This non-vanishing B? I mean, it's a choice.
That's
of,
precisely.
It's a choice of vacuum. It's.
Well, that's precisely a good question. If I can write it as an effective action, where I have a controlled high-scale expansion in a mass scale, then hopefully you will agree with me that it is a, maybe not directly a quantum effect, but certainly an effect of a completion of gravity with Planck-scale physics. If there is a suppression, corrections to general relativity, which are suppressed by the scale on Planck, and I can relate this number B to some of these corrections to the action, which are suppressed by a scale on Planck, then I have answered your question. Mm-hmm. You look puzzled. Let me go on. But that's precisely one of the open problems with this approach. You can clearly compute corrections, but what the interpretation of those corrections are is rather unclear. You've just changed your vacuum by hand, and it's no, you don't know what is the physics behind the change of that vacuum, or it even if there is physics.
It might be more to the story of the theta angle in Young-Mills theory. Theta also parametrizes different vacuum, and theta contributes to some observables. And, well, nature picks out a particular value for theta, but it's not. Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm just confused.
Okay. So let me go on, and then maybe the confusion will partly be clarified. Okay, so what we'd like to do is write an effective action approach, and what was immediately realized is when you try to write down an effective action which captures the corrections to general relativity, what you would be tempted to write down is just the normal action plus the scalar field part plus the potential. But then if I want to write down higher derivative corrections, general covariance, requires that if I add one more derivative, I add another one as well, contracting indices in simple language, and therefore the suppression scale with which this term appears in the action is second order in M Planck squared. So a correction to this action, M Planck, which is will always be by analyticity of at most of order h squared over M Planck squared. So it can never be a correction of this type, which is linear in h over m. Moreover, if h over m should be a small number, this correction will always be subleading to this number. And since the issue of the strength of the correction is rather important, particularly if the correction, if we are only looking in the CMB, where only 1% corrections or so can be measured, even in the most optimistic scenarios, this number is never larger than 10 to the minus 4. So these corrections, at least in the CMB, are not measurable. If we combine CMB with large-scale structure, as I mentioned earlier, then we can get to errors of statistical errors of 10 to the minus 6, and these corrections may be measurable. But a large amount of the debate, this is recent input from David Spergel, a large amount of debate actually was over whether you can see things in the CMB. So, of course, if you look a little bit further, what you realize is that this is in part of the action. This controls the dynamics of the theory, and this does not determine the boundary or the initial conditions. So it's quite clear that any corrections of this type will never be captured by corrections to an effective action like this. But it turns out that you can write and add an additional piece to the action, a boundary action, which does capture precisely the changes which just captured the boundary conditions, and therefore also high energy corrections to the boundary condition. So you can write down on a space-like hypersurface an action of the following type, where I've restricted myself to power counting or normalizable operators. And then what this action does, if you vary this action, you find that this theory, the field phi, will have to obey the following boundary conditions. The normal derivative of phi must be equal to minus k phi. And so what this kappa does for you is it parameterizes all possible boundary conditions. And if you recall the connection between Hamiltonian and Lagrangian formulation, that means that you parameterize a whole space of vacua that you can choose for your Green's function that you are computing. So I'm going rather fast now because I'm running out of time, but so please interrupt me for questions. The great benefit of having an action way of capturing the vacuum ambiguity in this case is that we can now, in a controlled way, try to see what happens if you include if you want to consider the corrections due to very high energy physics. In the same way as that the regular action has an expansion in derivatives over m, this boundary action can also receive corrections of irrelevant operators suppressed by high scale m. And
space at target surface is at infinity, minus infinity, what do you think?
I'm simply thinking of a space-like hypersurface at a time, at any fixed time.
It's not physically defined.
No. Actually, classically, this is an interesting question that, since this is a workshop, I will be completely fair and open now. Right? Classically, you can show that all the answers actually are independent of the, or there's a symmetry between where you impose these conditions and the coupling constants. Right? So you can always change this location eta naught and adjust the coupling constants accordingly, such that the physics is the same. Quantum mechanically, that actually appears not to be true, and we do not understand the physics why it is. I can show it to you mathematically, but why that is physically, I do not understand. So that's a rather big question. So the reason why I use express it classically, this is certainly, it doesn't matter where you put this space like hypersurface. You can show that explicitly by the Green's function. The classical Green's function has a symmetry where you can compute exactly how this kappa has to change if you change eta naught. Okay. So what is the leading irrelevant correction to this boundary action? Well, it's very easy to write down. It's something like phi d phi d phi, where the arrow on top it means that I'm only considering spatial momenta. And if you count the number of powers here, this is dimension 4. The integration measure of the boundary is dimension 3. So I only need a single power of the new scale m to make this dimensionally correct. And here you see again how indeed initial corrections to the initial condition have one naive suppression factor less than the dynamical correction to the action. So this can, in principle, explain this single power of h over m. And indeed, you can find formally, by just inverting this b, what is the correct combination of irrelevant operators. Actually, you need the whole series of irrelevant operators to get that exact b out. But you'll see what the boundary action is for that story. So in terms of, and vice versa, I can take this action and now write it in terms of this Hamiltonian language, which I'll do for simplicity because we know already what the shape of the power spectrum is. And what you find is that for this type of action, that this guy B is the following combination, is I times the scale factor at this time, eta naught, times the solution, homogeneous solution to the wave equation, squared, times this parameter beta, which parameterizes the strength of the irrelevant operator, times k squared over a over m.
Yeah. In theory, this was kind of, if I'm not mistaken, clear that there was such a way of doing it, because effectively you're just translating the Bogoliubov transformation quadratic thing in terms of an operator which does as an action which acts on a spatial hypersurface. So it's not as obvious, right?
Yeah.
Since you could write in SO3 invariant way something which in that operator form doesn't work, you just write the corresponding operator.
I completely agree with you, although when we wrote this up, I don't know anybody else who did this for us. So, it's not philosophically a great step, because what we're doing is we're parameterizing the vacuum immunity. We're not resolving.
I think the only issue is why are you allowed to add the boundary action? I think that's what's not trivial.
That's correct. That is correct. And actually, I will come to that in a second. Okay? So here you see this boundary action corresponds to this. Now, we did some work on sort of the consistency of these boundary actions just to convince ourselves and hopefully anybody who reads our articles that this is a completely consistent framework. You can renormalize, you can compute anything you want. This is effective actions. You can use, in fact, to answer Nathan's question, we computed the power spectrum both in the Hamiltonian way with this method, and in the field theory way with Feynman diagrams and then taking the imaginary part, and you all get the same answer. There are some subtleties which I'm completely ignoring here, but they are addressed in our paper, which have to do when you add, when some of the derivatives on the boundary have normal are normal components. But let me now go back to what this means. So there are sort of these two scenarios, and you see that the corrections are somewhat different. This correction has no explicit k dependence. Whereas here there is an explicit k dependence, and so you can try to figure out what this means for the actual observed cosmology. And now I will come to Kumun's question: is it was clear that you could do this, but whether this has any relevance to the real world is a big question. So. The main issue is if you now write down the two power spectra. So this scenario is often called the new physics hypersurface scenario, which is somewhat strange. This is the location where this is true is called the new physics hypersurface. It's not a surface in time or space. It's some combined momentum space-time hypersurface. The correction to the power spectrum looks as follows. It's the Bunch-Davy story, or the delta rho over rho is constant, times 1 plus an amplitude times the sine of the log of k. And actually, let me write one. This is k to the minus epsilon h, and then there's some additional number d here. The main thing what you see is that the oscillatory period is logarithmic in k, which makes it, which you should remember for the next. But the main issue here that you see is that the amplitude decreases with k. Epsilon is a positive number. So this conforms with your cosmological intuition. Actually, remember this, we would like to think of this as a correction due to quantum gravity or small scale effect. So remember, small scale effects actually should come at very early times, and therefore it should decrease with k. Remember the picture of the power spectrum. The CMB. This is Lyman alpha. And even though this is very high scales, right? So this is very small scales, but early times. Sorry, wait. This is large length scales. Let me. Right, and very early times. But this is this is where a cosmologist would expect quantum gravity effects. And this is precisely exemplified by this amplitude. This part dominates in the CMB part and is suppressed in the Lyman alpha part. Now if I use this effective field theory computation and you compute the corrections to the spectrum, you find the following combination. Is now you find that there is a linear piece in k, and then there are two things which are different. One is that the oscillations are not logarithmic in k, but linear in k. So that's good news. If you would tell an experimenter, you can easily distinguish one scenario from the other. But there's a confusing aspect about this, is that the amplitude grows in k. So what actually happens is that the correction due to what we think of as an high energy or quantum gravity correction to general relativity, this is all suppressed by a scale m. dominates at in the range of galaxy clustering properties. And a cosmologist would find it completely confusing. He would expect this is all determined by late-time cosmology, where general relativity is relatively well under control, so I don't expect any significant deviations from it. So remember, this is what I mentioned earlier, what this note was, what is confusing, is because as a field theorist, you would immediately pick out this as the reasonable correction to a power spectrum which is related to a Green's function. You expect that at high k, at high momenta, the corrections dominate, and not at low momenta. Remember, these are higher derivative corrections. So there is a clear paradox between your cosmological intuition and your field theory intuition of where the effects should dominate. This was indeed a scenario that was written down by cosmologists, and this was written down by ourselves who have our training as string theorists and field theorists. So ideally what you would like is actually something that is neither. Yeah, ds contains m. D contains m. That's correct. No, these are different. Completely different. These c's and d's are... And let me just put an m here to make it explicitly dimensionally correct. And here there's also a Hubble scale suppression, which is also dimensionally correct. I just want to emphasize the primary points. So, do I have 2-3 minutes left? Yeah. So, what I would like to emphasize is that this is the status where this story is now. And as you noticed, all we are trying to do is not very ambitious at all. We're not trying directly to compute string theory corrections in cosmology. At this moment, we're simply trying to understand effective actions or regular quantum field theory in cosmological backgrounds, which is still quite a conundrum. Even such a simple thing as the cosmological vacuum. But I would like to say that there's quite some progress in the field because especially this boundary effective action approach has shown quite conclusively that lots of these initial conditions that people thought were really inconsistent are in fact completely consistent. The freedom that these extra boundary terms give you gives you precisely the missing pieces that resolve inconsistencies in terms of back reaction and other things. However, you may question simply the philosophical scenario, what is the meaning of this space-like hypersurface? Now, there are some cosmological scenarios in the literature written down in the 70s and the 80s where people looked at sort of jumps between radiation and matter-dominated phases, or even a radiation-dominated phase before the phase of inflation. And precisely at the transition between the various phases, you can think of that as a space-like hypersurface here. And indeed, those kind of scenarios can be very well described by these type of actions. So if there's a phase transition at some point in the inflationary or pre-inflationary phase, this boundary effective action formalism indeed seems to be the one that's applicable. However, that's not what we think is going on, because this phase transition should have other effects, more prominent effects in the power spectrum already than this change in vacuum. So what seems to roll out of it is that this boundary effective field theory story to compute to resolve the classical vacuum ambiguity is a consistent story, but it's not the one that's applicable to cosmology today. It seems that something more like this must be going on, but the problem here is that this is not something we can yet interpret as an action, or to answer Stefan van Doren's question, we don't really know what's the physics behind this correction. It was simply an ad hoc Bogle-Yubov transformation to parameterize what is a possible correction to the physics, but we don't understand the underlying story. So ideally, you would like to have something of both. And this is what we are currently doing is a work in progress, but we made one remarkable observation. So even though we haven't at all worked out what is going on, I would like to show it to you, because there is a very natural candidate for this solution. So let me... grab my notes. So, what you would really like to do is you would like to understand effective field theory in curved space-time better. Because that's really what the story has been so far. So, some of you may remember that there is a very nice paper by Polchinski from 20 so years ago, where he tried to implement the effective field theory philosophy of Wilson manifestly in an action formulation. And what one does is one writes down an action, which in this case will contain a metric. And one introduces explicitly a cutoff function. In the action. And what one can do now, if one looks at the partition function with this theory, and one depends that the partition function is actually independent of where you choose the cutoff, or you find what's called the Polchinski RG flow equations, which you can relate to the normal RG flow equations for the coupling constants in your theory. And so this is a very nice action picture behind the usual renormalization story. Now what you can try to do is simply improve on Polchinski by not doing it in flat space-time, but try to do it in curved space-time. You may have to worry about issues like Euclidean versus Minkowski signature. I'm going to completely ignore it and assume that you can Euclideanize and then rick-rotate back. But what you find then is if you want to do, suppose that you have this action, and you want to look at the effective action for perturbations, you want to write down the Green's function. To write down the Green's function, you have to integrate by parts. And you find the following. So this f is a cutoff function that cuts off the high momenta. That's, of course, what I should have said. The following story. But now comes the observation that has gotten us rather excited to resolve the open issues that each of these previous attempts had. Is when I wrote this down, I integrated this covariant derivative by parts. In flat space, this is the whole story. But in curved space, of course, covariant derivatives do not commute. So there is a second term, which is phi, and you have to take the commutator of the covariant derivative with this cutoff function f. Now if you work this out, this is the usual term, you get the following. You get a derivative of the cutoff function f times r mu nu times d mu d nu plus d dot r mu d mu on phi plus some higher order terms, which I'm ignoring. Now why has this term, this extra term, gotten us all excited? By the way, if there are any questions and if my notation writing is not legible, please let me know. Remember that this f is some cutoff function that cuts off the very, very high momenta. So f is some function which, to first approximation, you can write as a theta function, like this. And all, what it does is it cuts off the very, very high momenta region. But now there's the second term that you find in curved space, which is proportional to r mu nu. Of course, there's a suppression factor here over lambda squared. So note that this term is therefore a curvature over lambda squared suppression. There's this second term, which is the derivative of this function as a function of its argument, f prime. But the derivative of a theta function, we know what that is. That's a delta function, roughly speaking. So what this suggests to us is that if you take an effective action in curved space and you introduce a cutoff function of this type, then not only do you automatically do your cutoff theory, you automatically introduce some type of boundary term, because if I take a bulk term and there's a delta function in it, that reduces to a boundary term on the location of my boundary. And this boundary term is at the zero argument of my delta function. Now, notice what happened here is that, roughly speaking, this delta function is the 4 momentum squared. So what changes compared to the previous story, the one that I erased here, the new physics hypersurface, which had a boundary when the 3 momentum squared was equal to the cutoff. This is roughly a boundary when the 4 momentum squared is equal to the cutoff, or the turn down. And so this has some of the nicer properties that the new physics hypersurface story had, in that it indeed agrees with your picture that it's when the momenta become very, very high that that's where you should impose sort of your initial conditions. So that's where general relativity as a low effective action starts to compete. And in a pure de Sitter case, I can work this out completely, and you show so precisely that what this does, it accounts correctly for the redshift factor. So you find that it's precisely when momenta redshift to the point of m that this term starts becoming relevant. But this it has that benefit. It has the natural intuitive benefit that was implicit in the new physics hypersurface approach. But it has this additional benefit of the effective field theory approach that we have here, a complete action principle. This is the action that I write down. So there are some subtle questions that still have to be worked out. But it seems that this term, which is new to my knowledge in having been written down, may be the answer to, or may contain part of the answer to the open questions that were still out there. And this has gotten us rather excited. It's not clear that it will be the answer, but this is what the work in progress is on this moment. And hopefully this will yield some results that we can tell our experimental cosmologist friends.
Any questions? What's the correction to power spectrum?
That's what we're working out. Actually, that turns out to be not so easy to compute, even though you would think it is. You have to very carefully deal with how do you evaluate, for instance, a delta function of this type. Okay, so what you can do is you can decompose all your functions into eigenfunctions. Complete set of eigenfunctions of the D'Alembertian operator. Now these are known for the de Sitter space, so you can start doing it there. But in a general space, they are not known. So we're just trying to do it for the de Sitter space. But even in the de Sitter space, people usually work with the sort of Hamiltonian formulation, where you only look at the homogeneous eigenfunctions. But here you need the whole complete set of eigenfunctions, also the ones that have non-zero eigenvalue on the Laplacian, and then you have to use completeness formula, you have to integrate correctly, and because these terms precisely, you have to keep track, very careful track of what they do. But that is what we are trying to compute right now.
Another question. So
you said the power spectrum bunch David vacuum is independent of K.
The Bunch-Davies vacuum, the power spectrum that you compute with the Bunch-Davies vacuum is independent of K, that's correct.
So what is the factor of K to the spectrum index? K to the NS?
Okay, so it's not quite... So for Bunch-Davies, roughly speaking, the power spectrum, the rho over rho, is H over 2 pi. In the slow roll inflation, H is not a constant. So H changes with time, or in other words, H changes with scale. So H changes as roughly K minus the slow roll parameter E. And you can relate that to what's called the... And usually this is parameterized differently. This is by definition parameterized as K to the NS minus 1. And NS is the object that is quoted in cosmology papers, that's the number that's measured. This is the scalar index, the index of scalar.
So this kind of running is quite different from the other kind of correction studying, right?
Yeah, so a big question which I haven't addressed at all here is how do you separate any corrections from quantum gravity from just in a slow standard slow roll inflation from simply changing the potential of your inflaton. So that is a very good question. At least in these corrections that I described that are due to changes of the initial conditions of the theory, they always have this oscillatory component. So that makes it very readily distinguishable. If there's not such an oscillatory component, then you have to worry far more about how to differentiate just simple the differentiation from pure scale invariance due to a change in the inflaton potential from changes in initial condition or from changes of quantum gravity. Although I should say that lots of these changes to the potential that people write down as saying, well, I can absorb this in this term of the potential, almost always they are irrelevant operators that they add to their theory. So in some sense, that is the change due to quantum gravity that they are doing. It's a topology, but not always.
Yeah. No, that's not hard, I guess.